Hey, everybody. The Air Raid Podcast is now sponsored by the American Brewing Company in Edmonds, Washington. They're one of the fastest-growing microbreweries in the Northwest, featuring the extremely talented brewmaster Skip Madsen. His breakaway IPA has become their number one bestseller. Stop by and find out why. You will not be disappointed. American Brewing Company. Drink domestic. Buy American.
Hey, Matt. Did you touch my drum set?
Nope.
It's just weird, because seems like someone definitely touched my drum set.
Yeah, that is weird, because I didn't touch them.
Hello and welcome, everyone.
Oh, hey.
This is the Air Raid Podcast.
I'm not joking around
episode
here.
Episode 65.
Woo!
In what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I'm your host, Aaron Roden.
Nobody beats me in the kitchen.
And yes, nobody beats me in the kitchen. But this is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you so much for downloading us, however you're getting us, on Stitcher, off the Noisebeam website, streaming from our website at air-raid.net, or finding us on Zune or iTunes or anything like that. It's great to have you. It's great to have you. We have got a great, fantastic show lined up for you today. The legendary Seattle music producer, Phil Eck, himself will be joining me shortly. I actually had Phil, this is kind of funny. Phil did not feel comfortable coming to my home, coming to Dining Room Studios, which I do not blame him because, you know, he's a very sought-after person. He is somewhat private, and he was like, you know, can we do this somewhere else? And so we lined up some studio time at Fisher Plaza, and sat in Ken Schramm's studio. If you're not from around here, Ken Schramm is a local radio talk show host. And we sat in Fisher Plaza and had a little discussion. So we'll be bringing that to you shortly. Actually, this I did this interview a couple months ago, and then after doing this interview with Phil Eck, made some promises to some people about getting some shows up. And so now, 2 months later, the Phil Eck episode is finally seeing the light of day. So here we are. Here we are. And I am in Dining Room Studios right now, coming to you high atop the Greenwood neighborhood here in beautiful Seattle, Washington. Getting ready to watch the Seahawks hopefully win a game today. They need a win, because we have lost the first two games of the season just horribly. I mean, doing so bad. And I don't know what it is about Seattle teams, but usually, I mean, you know, the Sonics were kind of going downhill for many years before they were booted from the city, or sold, you know, whatever. The Seahawks they haven't been doing too well for the past few seasons, and the Mariners are terrible. I don't know what it is. It's like a curse. It's a curse upon our house, our house being the city of Seattle. I don't know what it is about Seattle sports. I mean, the Storm, the Seattle Storm, the WNBA team here in Seattle is doing very, very well. And they have been doing very well for a while now, all the male leagues have been doing terribly for some time, and I don't know what it is. I think it's when people get here to Seattle, they get kind of lazy, because you know a lot of your time is spent inside with donuts and Netflix streaming. Speaking of Netflix. Holy crap, I'm sure everybody knows of this now, but they are They're splitting their web streaming, which will still be Netflix, and then their mail-in DVD service, which will be Quixtar. Quixtar is a terrible name, by the way. But I just wanted to say, I told you so! I knew this was going to happen. Remember in a couple episodes ago when they raised the prices and everybody was going AWOL or ape shit on how they were raising prices and everything, I said that this was not sustainable. Like, their business practice was not sustainable. They were going to have to raise prices and do something, and now they're doing it. They're becoming the big company that everybody, like, you know, left the big companies for. They are the ones in the seat now. They're the ones in the driver's seat, and a lot of people are angry that they're mixing stuff up. And you know, I don't really care. I am very proud of myself for being right about this, but it's got to be about money, right? It's got to be about money, because that's the only reason that they would have to, like, split things up. They just must, you know, they must be taking a bath in what they've been doing for so many years, and they're finally, you know, they've come out on top, and now it's their time to raise prices and make things all incorporated. Does that even make sense? That doesn't even make sense. Anyway, it's been a fantastic weekend. Let me just give you the rundown here really quick. We went to, a wedding on Friday. Maraid, maid of honor in our friend's wedding. Kyle and Kristen Stevens, or McCartney Stevens, whatever you want to say. Beautiful, beautiful wedding, but so freaking hot. Oh my God. I am not the type of person that wears a suit very often, but when I do, I am always, it could be like snowing outside and I will be so uncomfortable and so, like, my core, you know, I talk about this all the time, my core temperature, man. My core temperature was through the friggin' roof on Friday, and it was super, super hot, but it, beautiful, beautiful setting for a wedding. I was in West Seattle at this place called The Sanctuary. Awesome, awesome place, and great, great, beautiful ceremony and everything like that. So we wish Kyle and Kristen all the best. We love you guys so much, and it's gonna be a good marriage. It's gonna be a good marriage. I was saying how sometime in the future I would like to get up and just you know give a toast, and I would like to take the microphone. And I would like to say, and it would have to be, I mean, it'd have to be the right crowd, right? It'd definitely have to be the right crowd for saying something like this. I just want to say, you know, I love both of you guys so much, but I just don't think this is going to work out. Don't you think that would be hilarious? That would be so funny, right? It would definitely have to be the right crowd, though. It would... Because that could most likely blow up in your face. I mean, weddings are not just my age of people. There's a lot of grandparents at weddings and cousins and aunts and uncles that are not in my sarcastic generation, and that probably would not play out. And I told a couple of people that I was thinking about doing it, and they said, you know what, that's not a good idea. So I didn't, and it's a good thing that I didn't, because it would have exploded. It would have exploded. So anyway, yeah. Congratulations to Kristen and Kyle. Love you guys. I went out. I went gambling last night for the first time in a while, up to Goldie's here on Aurora, and kind of lost a bit of money up there. I have not been gambling in a while, and I realized that I just don't know how to gamble. Like, I just don't know how to play cards. I used to think I was okay at blackjack, you know, because I had a couple of hot streaks back in my early 20s and over at the Suquamish Casino, and you know, all that time is gone, man. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because, like, the casinos up here on Aurora, like the card houses, are so much smaller that maybe the odds are a little bit more against you in a place like that. I don't know. I don't know how it works. But yeah, I lost some money last night, man. Not too much, but enough to make a dent in my frickin' wallet. I mean, I can't be doing stuff like that too much, you know. I got a 5 month old. I got a 5 month old now, and a wife who you know is smarter than me and does not throw money out the window. So I'm gonna be careful. Be careful with that, right? Hey, just to remind everybody before we get to this interview with Phil Eck that we have been nominated by listener James for the Best of Western Washington, the King 5 Best of Western Washington podcast. So go to best.king5.com. That's best.king5.com. And type in the Air Raid podcast into the little search bar that they have there and vote for us. You do have to sign up for this. You can use like your Facebook account or something like that, or your Hotmail, or Gmail, whatever. What's cool about this is you have to sign up for it because you're not allowed to like vote twice and stuff like that. So I think that's why. But you do have to sign in, confirm, with your email address, blah blah blah. But please vote for us, search for us, the Air Raid podcast up there, and vote for us as one of the best podcasts in Western Washington. I think we've slid back down to like 13th place. We've been bouncing around from like 10th to 11th to 13th. So give us a hand. And there's 15 days left. Voting ends October 9th. Get on over to best.king5.com and only take a couple seconds and vote for us. That could be really good for us to make it into the top 10, I think. I'm hoping anyway. And that's the goal. That's the goal, though, is getting into the top 10. That's it. So give us a hand. And it doesn't matter where you're at. You don't have to be in Seattle to vote for this. So wherever you're at, London, Belgium, Poland, I know you're out there. Listeners in Poland. How about you listeners in Wisconsin, in Dodgeville, Wisconsin? Give us a little shout out there at the best.king5.com. Okay, well, you know what? Let's do this. We're going to go, first musical break before we get to the Phil Eck interview here. We're going to be featuring music all throughout this episode, stuff that Phil Eck has worked on, produced. This is one of the first things that he worked on. And it's a song by The Muffs. This is a great band. If you have not heard them, I really recommend that you check them out. And I believe they're actually still around. They're still playing. And they've been a band for a little while, and they are super, super good. I found out about them back in the 90s, when the Seattle was king of the grunge era. This fantastic band. Oldie but goodie. The song is I Need You, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast featuring the legendary Mr. Phil. Okay, we'll be back in a moment. We'll be right back.
All right, that was the Muffs with "I Need You Now," produced by the man that's sitting here with me in Fisher Studios, not dining room studios this time around. Mr. Phil Eck, the man, the myth, the legend. That's the second time I've said that now, and it still sounds uber dorky. Welcome, Phil. How's it going? Now you're rethinking. You're rethinking coming to this interview. But welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. Thank you so much for coming by.
Oh, you're welcome.
It is a huge pleasure to meet you and to get this chance to talk with you, because I have been listening. Let's see, when was the first Built to Spill? Let's see, on Up Record or CZ Records,
right?
What was
Ultimate Alternative Waivers?
Yeah, see,
Ultimate Alternative Waivers.
Yeah, always a tongue twister, right?
Yeah, that one I didn't do. That was the first one.
No,
I didn't do that one. That was done by Doug, basically, in Boise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Great. So I had my first fact totally wrong.
It's okay.
Awesome. Awesome. yay. So when did you... For people that don't know, you are kind of a legendary producer here in Seattle.
Thanks.
I would say.
Thank you.
I mean, I've been a lover of indie rock and music of that nature for quite a while, and your name has been on the albums, a lot of the albums that have made up my music collection. So. How did you get started doing this stuff?
Just being a kid, I grew up in Bremerton.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Kitsap.
Yeah.
Yeah, and me too.
Oh, you did? Where?
Yeah. Well, I grew up over in Indianola, so I was...
Close.
Yeah, good. I went to high school over in Paulsbo.
Oh, Paulsbo, North Kitsap.
North Kitsap. We were rivals.
Yeah, we definitely were.
Yeah. We just had John Roderick on the show, too, and he apparently... was born in Kingston.
Oh.
I think... No, wait. Maybe he was Bremerton, too, because I knew we were rivals as well. Anyway, sidetrack. So you grew up over in Bremerton.
Yeah, and I would come over here with my good friend from high school to shows and to record stores and Fallout and places like that. And just got really excited by local music that he turned me on to. He turned me on to Sub Pop and things like that that I didn't really know much about.
And what year was this?
Probably 88, maybe.
88,
something
okay.
Like that. I guess I was probably a junior in high school.
Uh-huh.
And, just that started the idea of, well, I was always into music, always excited by music and played music and listened to my brother's record collection and things like that. And, I just decided I guess I didn't decide. I was just really excited by music. That was the only thing that was constant in my life that I was excited to do. And,
and
came over to, decided after high school to go to the Art Institute. And for the recording or the music video program.
Right.
And it just went from there.
Cool. So were you a musician?
Play guitar,
at that time, too?
Yeah, play guitar.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Were you ever any good?
I'm better than I am now. but, it was more just music in general that I was interested in, not necessarily
right.
One particular aspect of it. But
yeah.
Music,
what kind of stuff were you listening to when you...
When I was a kid.
When you found, because everybody has that point in their life when they're just like,
for sure.
Shit.
Yeah,
just blew me away. By the way, you can swear if you want.
Fucking awesome. I grew up with my older brother, who's my biggest musical influence.
Uh-huh.
We were both into Kiss when we were kids, and we both dressed up in, Ace Frehley and stuff like that.
And, wait, did you do the face makeup
and
everything?
We had the official Kiss makeup kit.
Nice.
Yep, we definitely did. And for many years, it was Ace Frehley. That was it.
That was it. That was all you listened to.
Well, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then, I just was mostly a rock guy, listened to Metallica.
Uh-huh.
But it was, I was maybe 10th grade or so that I got into Joy Division and the Smiths and Cure and the Misfits.
Right.
And those were things that really changed my mind up. Yeah.
Nice. Was it kind of the lo-fi sound that kind of grabbed you a little bit?
I don't know if it was the sound. It's probably just I just thought the songs were interesting, and it was something I hadn't really heard when I was prior to that point. Just listened to AC/DC and Van Halen and Metallica.
Right.
That's about it.
Kevin, our acting producer engineer for the show today was like, before you got here, we were talking about producers, music producers. What's the name? What's the name? Mutt something? Mutt? Chime in whenever you whenever you're ready. I can't hear you.
Well, do you want me to answer?
Yeah, yeah, you answer.
Mutt Lang.
Mutt Lang. Yeah, yeah. There it is. There it is. So, was listening to this stuff. Did you start to look at kind of the behind the scenes of this music that you were looking that you were
yeah.
into and
yeah, I think it was really was on these trips over to Seattle from Bremerton on the ferry, going to Fallout and Orpheum and those places and buying independent records and most of them being Sub Pop.
Uh-huh.
That was totally I was enthralled by that. I thought that
right.
was the coolest thing in the world. Like this. Big city of Seattle was making really cool music that I was totally fresh to me and totally exciting to me. And
yeah,
so I buy these records and, you know, we take them apart and, oh, they're on colored vinyl or they have posters or something really cool about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But most 99% of them were done by Jack and Dino. And I just thought that was so cool. And then, you know, to me, he could have been a 55-year-old, you know, I don't know, some grandpa somewhere that, you know, just kind of had his own weird world, but it turns out he's this nice young guy at the time. And
yeah,
and I thought
yeah.
that was really exciting. So that was a big deal to me was to, uh-huh. to see that somebody in Seattle could make records.
Right.
That's really
right.
cool.
Yeah.
I want to do that.
Cool. Cool. And so you kind of, you came over here to go to the Art Institute of Seattle.
I did.
What was that school like at the time?
Yeah, it was pretty awful actually at the time. I mean, I don't know much about it now, but
yeah.
At the time you had no electives. You took the whole course, but you had to learn advertising and salesmanship and things that I didn't have any interest at all in.
Right. Right.
So I was pretty,
so it's like the, it's kind of like the, what the 100 level classes that you have to take in
yeah.
in any kind of college setting.
Yeah, basically.
The prereqs.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
To get everything out of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but it was, there were some really great teachers there. The studio was pretty, you know, I didn't know at the time, but it was pretty archaic for even for 1990.
Yeah.
And there's some really great teachers. This guy, Jim Rivers, and this guy, Keith Livingston, and Tom Dyer just let me work with them. And,
yeah.
And it was Tom that, who owns Green Monkey Records? You ever heard of Green Monkey Records? The Green Pajamas and things like that?
I don't think so, no.
Uh-uh. Check it out. He's a cool guy, and he actually kind of restarted the label, but he's...
They're running now?
Yeah, yeah. He was kind of on the same time frame as Conrad Udo and Pop Llama. You ever heard of Pop Llama?
I have heard of Pop Llama,
same,
yeah.
Same,
yeah.
Same time period, I guess, of putting out records, but Tom kind of started it up again. But he was just so nice and super cool, and I told him I was kind of going to quit, and he said, you know, I think you have... something, you could make something from this, and he was just really helpful, and he's the guy that introduced me to Jack and Dino.
Oh, okay.
And that was really a pivotal point.
Wow, did that just, like, blow your brain apart?
For sure. You know, I guess I was 19 still, maybe 20.
Had he done anything with Nirvana at that point?
Oh, yeah. Bleach was already out.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so this is 90, so the record, Bleach right. came out in 89, and, oh, yeah, he was still, you know, the biggest, coolest guy you can, you know, in music at the time, especially to me.
Right.
And yeah, I got a chance to assist him for a couple of years.
God damn, dude. That's awesome.
It was cool.
That is so awesome.
Yeah, Tom called up Rich Hinklin, who owned this studio called Word of Mouth, and Jack that was prior to called Reciprocal.
And
Jack,
okay, and so this is kind of set up by like one of your teachers.
This is by Tom Dyer from
okay.
worked at Art Institute.
Right, right. Did he see something in you that just
no,
like
apparently
was
so.
Like this kid is going to go somewhere with this or
I think
what?
To be honest, I think I was one of the few people in my class that just wasn't there to get their band signed to a label.
Right, right.
I mean,
okay.
There was a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which is crazy.
Well,
why
especially
would you go to school to get your band signed
right,
to a label.
Right, right. Well,
you know,
especially
these
at that time
are,
too, like 90s. You know,
yeah.
Almost every band that came out of Seattle was getting some sort of record contract.
Not at that time.
Not at that.
No,
early?
This is prior. This is prior to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is,
okay.
I mean, that did happen for sure, but this
right,
is 1990
right.
before Nevermind came out, before
the
international
okay.
stage was set.
Right. Right.
But you know, there's still
second fact. Totally wrong. Yeah.
Really blown it, dude.
Well, we could just end it now.
Peace.
So you get hooked up with Jack and Dino, and I mean, because I was a self-proclaimed musician for a little while. I guess I still kind of dabble in it, but you know, have kind of, I don't know. Once you're not in a band, you kind of just lose touch with it after a little while.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not doing anything with it,
focusing on it.
Right. Right. But I mean, I would always think that, like, if my band ever got like an opening slot or something with a band that I really admired or anything, like, I would just be so nervous that I wouldn't even be able to probably play.
Maybe.
I might vomit or something like that. I don't know. But were you super nervous when you met Jack?
Yeah. I mean, so long ago, but yeah, I think I was excited.
Right.
More than anything else.
Yeah.
I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know how old he was. You know, I kind of knew what he looked like, but he was just the nicest. He's incredibly smart.
Uh-huh.
He's an electronical engineer before going into engineering and producing.
Cool.
Amazing musician and just really stoic and, just very thoughtful man. Very smart guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very helpful.
Yeah. So was this kind of like a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like an internship capacity
Completely.
Or something?
Yeah, no,
or?
I was barely even that. I mostly
like
just
going and getting coffee, plugging mics in, and
dude,
stuff
I got
like
him.
That.
I got him carrot juice and chicken many, many times. Many times. No, mostly it really was just putting up mics and running cables and just sitting in the corner and watching what he did.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
was mind blowing to me because I had no idea what he was doing.
Right, right.
It's like the way he would describe things to bands and the way he would guide the performances of bands.
Uh-huh.
I had never seen that before. I mean, my little bit of recording experience was just in the studio by teachers with classmates, except for like four track kind of things.
Right, right.
So I'd never seen anybody direct a band.
Yeah.
And he was just really good at it and really methodical.
Well, therein lies a big question in my mind. Like what does a good producer do for a band? What is the capacity of your job in the recording studio?
Yeah, that changes from band to band.
Uh-huh.
But you're
depends on how much they want to give you, like,
and how much they need.
Okay.
Some bands don't need much. They're just a really great band that is savvy in the studio and understands it. They don't need much.
Uh-huh.
You just let them be the band. So that's being a good producer, is let them just be what they're good at.
Right, right.
You know, your main thing to do is just, I guess, just help them be the best they can be.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't know that, and you have to show them.
Uh-huh.
A good relationship in the studio is when they fully let you.
Yeah.
Let you guide them to making the best music they can make.
Yeah, so I mean, well, how does that work? Can you go into a little bit in depth into that? So let's say a band comes in and they want to work with you. You like their sound and stuff like that, so you're willing to, you know, take them on, mm-hmm. take this project on. Mm-hmm. And then they come into the studio and they need some help.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So like do you just this is something I was talking to Kevin a little bit earlier. Like, do you come in and you listen to a song,
mm-hmm.
and you're hearing stuff that they're not playing,
mm-hmm.
in your head?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Sometimes it's just explaining and letting them know that what they think is an inconsequential part of the song is actually the best part of the song.
Right,
Don't tuck that away. Bring that out. That should be the forefront. That should be the most important thing you're hearing and most important thing to build a song off of.
Okay. So you become an integral part of the band at that point then, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're definitely a part of the process. You're definitely,
yeah.
You know, that's record producing. You're in it with them to make the best record that they can make.
Yeah.
That they can make and bring out the best thing that they are, bring out the best of their songs and their musicianship and their singing. Singing is a huge part of it.
Right, right.
And
that's become like a huge part of the new Seattle sound too, is singing and the harmonies and stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that in a little bit. But let's go to our first, our second musical break here. And we're going to go with, something from Built to Spill, There's Nothing Wrong With Love, off their album There's Nothing Wrong With Love, which you produced, correct? Did I have that one right?
I did. That was the first one I did.
That was the first one you did?
Nothing I Would Love? That you
yeah.
Said? Yeah, that's yeah. the second record. Yeah. That's
okay, okay. And this one has that little disclaimer at the end of the record, too, which I always love. Phil Eck here with a preview of the next Book's Full record. Yeah, that's great. So this is the song In the Morning off of Up Records, 1994. And I'm sure you can find this on iTunes and everywhere else. So Built to Spill, In the Morning, and we'll be right back with more from Phil Eck on the Airwave Podcast. Come on. We are back. That was Built to Spill, In the Morning, the magic of podcasting. that was, you were saying before we left, that was the second record that you produced.
Oh, that was there, Built to Spill.
Oh, so, yeah, yeah, Built to Spill.
It might have been my, not too many into it.
Yeah, yeah. Because you did, let's see, when did you actually officially
start making records?
Yeah.
I guess the first thing I did... God, you know what? It's funny. I don't think the very first thing I did that came out on a label was that Muff single, but maybe it was. That was 92.
And that was on Sub Pop.
That was on Sub Pop. That was a big deal.
Yeah. So I read up a little bit on you because you have a Wikipedia page. I don't know. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah,
That's where I get all my facts.
I run it.
Yeah. I wrote it myself.
Yeah.
Under an assumed name.
Yeah.
But so it says here that you started out like just recording like live like shows or something.
No, that's not entirely true.
Wikipedia.
I worked at the Off Ramp. I was a live sound guy.
Oh, but okay.
I was just doing monitors and stuff like that mostly.
Yeah.
But, that was pretty cool.
It's nice. Fun. And that was kind of what you're like.
Let's see. How old am I? I guess I was late 90 into beginning of 92, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Because I wasn't 21.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So that's why it was fun.
Yeah. That's always kind of a good time when you get into the bar underage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Especially if you're running the board.
Well,
so you get to like meet
monitor.
The bands and
mostly doing
like
monitors,
that.
So they usually were probably pretty, you know, I couldn't really, they either were psyched or mad at me.
Yeah, right. Did you ever get more me in the monitor, please?
That's the rule.
Yeah.
That happens every day.
So what kind of bands did you work with at that?
Just
at the
local bands at that time. I mean, you know, Mudhoney played there a couple times.
Yeah,
I worked
yeah.
there. Like Nirvana played there, but I didn't actually work that night.
Uh-huh.
But just all the local bands at the time.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Did you ever meet John Roderick there? Because apparently he used to work at the Off Ramp as well.
So I met John Roderick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a door guy when I was a monitor guy.
Right. Yep. He's tall enough to be a door guy.
Yeah.
He must have been about the same age as you, too, right?
I think he's a couple years. I think he was legal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm
okay.
pretty sure.
Okay.
I think he's older. I know he's older.
He's super old.
He's really old.
Hope he doesn't listen to this. He probably won't.
Probably
You're going to be the only one that listens to this, Phil.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. No,
real time.
Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. We have zero downloads on this one.
Nobody cares.
That's right. I think if we swear a bunch, then we'll get more listeners, because that's what people love, is the fucking swears.
No shit.
So, you're working at the off ramp as a
monitor guy.
Monitor guy. Yeah.
Not even the big guy.
and so you probably met a bunch of really cool bands through that, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Urge Overkill played. That was pretty cool. Smashing Pumpkins played. I had to hold the monitor in front of Billy Corgan because the crowd was surging forward. And
are you serious?
He kept getting hit in the face with a microphone, and he asked me to hold the. He goes, "Can you hold this monitor in front of me?" So I had to sit on the ground and hold the monitor with him right behind me,
like on the stage.
Yeah. While his piercing nasal voice was blasting in my face with the speaker, just sitting on the ground.
Oh my god! Oh my god!
That was pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, and then, were they even?
That was on their Gish tour, so they were.
Oh, okay.
They were starting to get a good following
at that point.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, then how did you make the move then from being like a sound guy at a club to doing
records?
Producing.
Oh, gee, that's a long process.
Were you going to school at that point?
Yeah, I was going to school then.
Oh, okay.
And then during that time period is when Tom, the teacher,
right,
introduced me to, you know, Richie, Clint, and Jack and Dino.
And did you realize at that point too? I mean, this, I'm kind of jumping around here, but when you were working with Jack, at what point did you go, oh my god, this is for me. This is it.
Oh, before that.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that was just a luck, being the right place, right time, having a nice teacher help me out. But yeah, I was always definitely interested. I guess I was always interested. I wasn't sure I was going to want to do it until I started doing it. And then it was just really fun.
Yeah,
But yeah, you definitely. I mean, you start as just an engineer, and you're setting up
microphones, learning how to like set the studio up
how to record, how to make things sound cool.
Yeah. And everything's on tape at that point, too. Oh yeah, there's no digital.
There was digital, but really, really bad digital.
Yeah.
And no one had it.
far too expensive or something?
The stuff that was good, I guess, was really expensive. And the stuff, or what was considered good. And the stuff that was bad was just really cheap and terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Like ADATs were just coming around at that point.
Which is
terrible sounding stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Do you still use tape a lot now, then?
You know, not really. It's still out there. There's two companies that still make it. All the other companies, the main ones, have all gone bankrupt. Or just shut it down for various reasons. I do still use it, but it's not. It's just not what it used to be, and it kind of is a pain in the butt. It doesn't sound as good, and it's not as well made. So,
yeah,
it's more just
it takes a lot of care too. Like I've heard stories about like
falling apart,
storing
and
tape and stuff, or like getting it gets all gummy.
It can,
right?
Yeah, well, it can. It can get moldy sometimes, or it can get too. If it gets dried out, it actually literally crumbles.
Really?
Or kind of crumbles. The oxide comes off of it.
Right, right.
But it's mostly the digital just sounds so much better than it used to.
Yeah.
The digital medium is much more advanced, and it does sound nice.
Well, it's got to be easier to set up too, right?
It's incredibly easy.
Yeah.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Not to buy the equipment, but to just buy a hard drive. That's all a band needs anymore. You don't need hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of tape anymore.
So do you now like work out of your own studio?
I don't.
Oh, you don't?
Nope.
Oh,
okay. I work out of, in Seattle, Bear Creek Studios and Avast Studios. I don't really have much of an interest in owning a studio because they break.
You constantly have to fix stuff.
You do.
Yeah.
And you have people like me showing up and saying, hey, this is broken. Fix it. And then they go, that cost me money. And I say, so what?
Yeah. Well, it's not my fault.
you fix it. It's not mine.
Yeah. So walk me through the process a little bit of how this works. So you get a band that approaches you?
Usually, yeah.
Okay.
Usually. I approach them, but usually through the band, or the band's management.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and if I like it, I do it, or I try to, you know, hopefully do it. But I have to be 100% into it to want to do the record, because it's just, you know, it's in everybody's best interest that the producer is as psyched or more psyched on the music than the band. So I choose the records I want to do, and we go and try to make a good record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah.
That's it?
I don't know. It's hard to describe. I mean, do you want to know like when you're in the studio, what do I do?
How yeah.
Oh, this is about studios. Sorry.
No, we got it.
You know, you set up the band in the main room, like a band would set up when they're practicing. Everybody's isolated, but they're all in the same room.
Right, right.
And you just start playing the songs as a full band, but you pretty much are only really keeping the drums, because that's the hardest thing to record and the hardest for the drummer to play.
Yeah.
You want to be in time and all that. That's how you start.
Yeah.
And if you get, you know, a great bass take along with the drums, you keep that, or just do a couple of fixes on it, and then you have your rhythm section done. Then you're just building up the parts, overdubbing after that.
Right.
You know, the guitar player usually is in the control room with me, listening to playback through speakers, playing along.
So now with, like, you know, using digital equipment and stuff like that, it's got to be much easier just to do like isolated tracks, I guess.
It's the same. It's the same process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, you still can. You said you basically, the way you do digital recording is the exact same way you would do tape recording, as far as number of tracks, or I guess the difference is number of tracks is pretty much endless with digital.
Right.
So you can just overdub and build the song up one person at a time.
Uh-huh.
And then vocals usually are last.
Excellent. Well, hey, let's go to our third musical break here. I think I've got that right. We're going to go with The Shins, another album that you produced, Shoots Too Narrow. Another one on Sub Pop, 2003. This one's called Fighting in a Sack. And we'll be right back with more from Phil Ack on the Air Raid podcast. All right. Okay, we are back. That was Fighting in a Sack by The Shins off of Shoots Too Narrow. What are your thoughts on auto-tune?
You know, I have done it before.
Only on just, like, voices and stuff?
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. But only in the last resort kind of thing. Sometimes you get a vocalist that just almost got to an opening and quite get there.
Uh-huh.
And they blew their voice out, or their voice got really hoarse or something, and you couldn't keep doing it, which is normally the way I would do it. Then it's like, oh, whatever. Let's just even that out. It's no big deal. But that's the rarity for sure.
Yeah.
Try not to do it. It just sounds bad.
Right,
The sound of it sounds bad.
So did you like Kanye West's album that he used auto-tune for every song?
But that's a different thing. That's like, use auto-tune as an effect, as opposed to a corrective device, which is what it's, you know.
What it's made for.
Well, initial intention was, yeah.
How did that get made? I heard a rumor on that it was like actually constructed for Britney Spears?
You know, I don't know. That might be true, but I don't know.
Kevin's laughing back there.
I don't know who invented it, but the idea of it, and pretty much everything that a digital plugin does, or the actual device of Pro Tools or whatever, mm-hmm. all those things are things that were done in some capacity in the analog form. People have been pitch shifting vocals since recording started.
How do you do that?
Originally, they just sped the tape up or slowed it down. Okay. So if an artist couldn't hit the note, they would slow the tape machine down. So
right,
it would be
right.
like a half step lower. So it would be a little bit lower key so they could sing that note. Then they'd speed the tape back up. And then, because you don't do it too much, it would sound fine. But
right.
if you, did, you know, it would sound, or if you did it, you know, if you did do it too much, it would sound kind of like Mickey Mouse voice.
You Holy crap, like, man. You really got to know your shit to do
Led
stuff
Zeppelin.
Like that. A lot of Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, yeah. It's true. But, and then people had, there's pitch shifting devices that have been around forever that people have used in, you know, country music, especially.
Right. Well,
forever.
they make pedals for guitars and stuff like pitch
definitely,
shifters. And
definitely.
Everything.
So they've had like a fancy rack unit in studios for, since the 70s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But then now there's a, you know, it's much more advanced, obviously, but that's kind of where it came from.
Totally. Let's talk about a little bit about some of the bands that you've worked with.
Cool.
So you were saying like Built to Spill, mm-hmm. you've worked with them a lot. You've done well, with the exception of the album that I had wrong. alternate alternative waivers.
Oh, I said it.
Ultimate alternative waivers.
Yes. You didn't do that one, but you've pretty much you've done every one since, right?
No, I haven't done the last two.
Oh, you haven't?
No, nope. Well, I did
Fact three. Jesus.
No, I didn't do the last two. I did
okay.
Let's see, I did There's Nothing Wrong With Love. There's a Built to Spill Caustic Resin EP.
Right.
Let's see, Perfect From Now On, Keep It Like a Secret, Ancient Melodies of the Future, and the live record.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah. And did you do the actual like live recordings for that one?
Actually, Stuart Hollerman did.
Okay.
But he has all the equipment. I was doing live sound for them.
Okay.
And he set up all the stuff that it's called a snake, a splitter, and he set it up to record all the Pro Tools.
Gotcha.
So.
And so how has it been working with all those guys?
With Built to Spill?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. I love those guys.
They are super nice. They just seem like they would be like a super nice bunch of dudes.
They are. They
that
are
really into jamming.
They are into jamming. They do like to do that.
So if you ever...
But yeah, they're amazing. They're amazing musicians.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and they fit so well together too. Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, yeah. Have you ever worked with a band that just like you could see that like they make good music mm-hmm. now,
mm-hmm.
but it's not gonna happen in the long run or because they just don't get along or something.
Yeah, there's been bands that over the years there's been bands that you just can see them breaking up.
Yeah, during the recording process.
Yeah.
I've witnessed it in my own living room.
Actually. Oh, yeah.
we won't talk about that. But is there you got some? I'm sure you have some pretty good stories about recording some bands. Can you grace us with some of these?
Oh, jeez. I can't think of anything right now.
We can cut that air out. It's totally cool.
You know, I'd be honest. Like, I was these things you'd ask on the spot, and I just
right.
You know, I don't really think of them that way. You know, there's things that happened. I guess if I knew of something more interesting than anything else I could tell you, but you know, I think they all have their moments. You know, the records are hard to make, and there's a lot of emotional, you know, aspects wrapped up into it. You know, and feelings get built up and brought down constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
And by that, man, you can really have some people, you know, can kind of break down or just become incredibly funny.
Have you ever had to like crack the whip a little bit?
You always have to crack the whip.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your job is directing a movie. You're guiding the performance of a record and of a player, of a singer, of a drummer. And you know, it's hard work. It's not something that rarely does a studio just kind of happen.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of, everything you hear on the process of a record is, a lot of work and a lot of time spent.
Right.
Getting the sounds and getting the performances and getting the just the whole content to all make sense.
Right.
That's an anthem.
Well, and getting everybody to work together too, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
so, totally.
That's a huge part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Be a band.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I've had some experiences in the studio, and it's always, I don't know what it is, if it's just like, you know, playing in front of people that you don't know, or just being nervous that you're playing in front of a dude that sees a bunch of different bands come through here,
mm-hmm.
and always thinking like, oh, we're going to be that shitty band that this guy talks about with his
right.
other producing or,
right.
or recording friends.
Right.
I mean, can you see that coming? Can you sense that in a studio? Like, I've always wondered about that. Like, you know, being in there myself and just being like, I hope he just realizes that I'm super nervous playing in front of him.
Oh,
I'm not that shitty.
No, for sure. That's happened. That happens to the best of people.
Right, right.
It's a weird experience. You're wearing headphones and yeah, there's a guy through a glass window in a faraway room that's watching you play.
Yeah, telling you to play it again.
Telling you to do it again. Yeah. There's nothing. There's no part of music and there's no part of being in a band that is the same.
Uh-huh.
As being in the studio. Everything else, you know, when you're practicing, you're playing shows, you're writing songs, that's all easy. I mean, not easy, but that's you're relaxed. You're just doing your thing.
Right, right.
In the studio, it's a completely foreign space, foreign headspace
yeah.
to be in. And I try, and I think that's one thing my earlier days I wasn't as good at, was communicating to the band that I'm not judging you, I'm helping you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm judging your playing, but I'm not judging you as a, if you fuck up a ton of times, that's part of making records. To me, that's nothing to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it took me a while to get to relay that better.
Right. Right. Use your words.
Yeah. Use my mouth hole.
Right. Right.
Well, yeah, it's something that, you know, especially, you know, I've been fortunate the records I've done have done quite well.
Yeah.
And that has led me to even have more ability to just take, I really just choose the records I want to make. So I hope that anybody
right.
that I'm working with, and I think they know it now, is I'm there because I want to be.
Yeah.
And I always
yeah.
was, but I don't think people knew that.
Right.
Or as much.
As much.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I mean, along with being able to spot somebody like a musician that's kind of nervous or, you know, along those lines. Can you also, have you gotten to the point in your career where you can spot a band that's like, you can just point them out and you can be like, man, those guys are going to be huge.
Definitely. Well, I don't know. Definitely. But,
yeah.
Yes. I felt that way about the Shins. I felt
uh-huh.
that way about Band of Horses.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you about Band of Horses.
Band of Horses was a band, you know, their first record was a huge, it was a lot of work,
right.
but it was a record that I went into, I didn't even know Ben. We just kind of met a couple of times around
uh-huh.
the time,
yeah.
you know, when they did these demos and were playing a band. I didn't know him, and Chris is weird at all. I didn't, never even met him before.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't until we got in the studio on that record that every song I knew was great. It was just about getting them to that point or getting that performances of them. Cause every song just seemed like a home run to me.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of work to get for Ben. He sings really loud and really high and wasn't a singer before this. And
he wasn't even really a guitar player before that, too, right?
Still isn't. No, I'm just kidding.
He won't hear this, don't worry.
No, I'm just joking. No, I mean, Ben's a funny guy. He's a songwriter.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
doesn't necessarily mean you have to be the best musician in the world.
Right.
And I'm not saying this other than, me and him always joked about his guitar playing.
Yeah.
It's you know, he's it's still kind of hard for him to play, as it were, in the studio.
Uh-huh.
But he's a great songwriter. And that record had nothing but great songs on it. And I was so excited by it and excited to work with him. And I think that was, you know, a big achievement for both of us.
Right. And what was that experience like working with them in the studio?
It was pretty fun.
Yeah.
You
said it was a lot of work though.
Oh yeah. His singing took a lot of work.
Uh huh.
And that was, you know, he rose to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
It made him a better musician for
right,
sure.
Right.
And, cause he had never, when you're, you know, he was 25 or something at the time, 24. And, if you haven't really been in a studio before as a singer and you haven't been under that kind of...
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it was definitely a lot of pressure for him. And it was just, I remember saying to him, you know, you can get mad at me all you want because, you know, I'm telling him to do over and over and over again, explain to him why he's flat or whatever.
Right,
get mad at
right.
me all you want, but it's going to matter. Or it does matter. And at the end, you'll see the results.
Yeah.
And he fully did.
Yeah. So really you're cool. kind of like a personal trainer.
Yeah, you know.
Do it again.
Yeah.
Give me 10 more.
Yeah, yeah.
Dude.
Well, to me, you know, to be a good record producer, you have to be able to be okay with not being the most loved person in the room.
Right,
People
right.
are going to get mad at you. They're going to be,
yeah.
you know, you're out there singing your ass off and someone's telling you to do it again. That's not what you want to hear. You want to hear someone say, that's awesome, and we're moving on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't do that until I believe that it's actually done and it's good and we're moving on.
Uh-huh.
And so that can take hours.
Yeah. And that's, I'm just like, while you're telling me these stories and stuff, like, I'm like, I keep on thinking about times that I've been in the studio and like, I'm super lazy. And I just like, I would get so sick of playing that part for that song or singing that line
totally.
Over and over again. Like, I would just say, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I am not a famous musician.
It is that. I mean, it does come down to, you know, diligent work.
Right, right.
You have to, and it's no, very few bands want to continue doing the same thing over and over again.
Right, just, right. Yeah.
It takes a lot out of you, a lot of energy and a lot of emotional, you know, stress kind of to get to that space.
But, has anyone broken in the studio
sure.
in front of you?
Sure. Yeah.
Like who?
I'm not going to tell you. But yeah, it's tough. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some people get really pissed.
Uh-huh.
Some people get at themselves or me or...
Right. Have you ever felt like you were in danger?
No.
You don't have to name any names.
No. Ben from Band of Horses did sing most of that first record holding a knife, though.
What?
He really did.
What are you talking about? What?
He
just like to himself?
No,
like
just in the air.
Okay.
So we're in the studio and... He just kind of said, what do people do? What do they, he holds his hands
yeah,
up
what do they hold? What
do you do with this? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Cause he's just like, I feel awkward because he's used to having a guitar.
Right, right.
He
yeah.
also hasn't
yeah.
been in the studio really as a singer. So he's like, what the hell? This is ridiculous. So he decided that he wanted to lean against something. And I said, well, some people hold a guitar, but don't play it. And he's like,
right,
oh, I'll just play it. And it'll be noisy. And you'll hear clicky clacky in the back of the track. So I can't do that. So he took a mic stand and lowered it, like on the boom mic, lowered it down and kind of rested his hand against it. So he had one thing to do with his left hand,
right.
but he didn't go through with his other hand. So he went out to the little kitchen area. This is a studio called Avast. And he went to the kitchen and grabbed a serrated bread knife and kind of did this sort of...
Like, you know, he was some sort of pirate?
Kind of, yeah.
It's like and, yeah. a swashbuckler?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really hilarious and kind of weird and pretty funny. But he'd also scratch his beard with it. It was really gross.
Did you throw that knife away after?
Yeah, sterilized.
Yeah.
But it actually really, it definitely helped him.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I remember Matt Brook, who was a guitar player at the time. I think he's been on this before.
Yeah, we've had him on, maybe 10 episodes ago, I think.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
But he was a guitar player at the time. And, you know, Ben was out there. And honestly, the beginning of his singing on that record was pretty bad. He was shouting at me. It just sounded like he was kind of screaming at me. It didn't sound like he was controlling he wasn't singing. He was
just kind of
yelling. And wasn't quite getting to the notes. And actually, it was Matt who said, "Act like you're at the top of a mountain, singing out, or act like you're at the bow of a ship, and you're like cascading out." And that's totally helped him. And then holding onto a knife, as it were, helped him to like reach up and sing loudly. And it was great.
Yeah,
night and day.
Yeah, you know, you should have had a. And this is going to be a joke about how the way he sings this line, but he should have had a sword with him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ba-dum-tsh. That's terrible. That was terrible. So,
make fun of a guy.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully he never hears this. I kind of doubt it, though.
I'm going to send him the link.
So, let's see. Who have you worked with recently?
The Fleet Foxes is probably the last thing, full record I did.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mixed Josh Tillman, the drummer's, newest solo record. couple months ago.
Cool.
And it's great.
did they come to you, or did you go to them?
I met Robin when he was a kid. I met him when he was 17.
Isn't he still kind of a kid?
Well, he's 25. So yeah.
Oh, he's 25
he's still
now.
He's still a kid. But yeah, I met him when he was really young, and he was a very talented kid then, mm-hmm. and he had. He had started writing songs, and he said, you know, if I ever get anything together, would you help me out? And
yeah,
he made a demo, the first, I don't know if you ever heard their very first like 5-song kind of EP demo that was kind of going around when they first started playing.
I don't know. What, was it playing on KEXP?
Yeah, they played some.
Yeah, I've probably heard it.
More of a kind there. Of a sort of 60s pop song.
Right,
not
right,
quite as,
yeah.
It was more electric.
Yeah.
But he did, recorded all that in their parents' basement, and then I mixed it for him.
Oh, cool.
And that kind of just started our work relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So one last thing before we take off here. You've had a lot of success as a producer with many of these bands. Mm-hmm. Modest Mouse, The Shins, Band of Horses, Mudhoney. which is one of my personal faves. This is going to be kind of a weird question, but it's more just for me because I've always been curious about it. How does the payment structure on this stuff, like once one of these albums that you've produced mm-hmm. has like made it big, like mm-hmm. let's say Band of Horses, for example, mm-hmm. Because there's, you know, a band that everybody knows mm-hmm. now. How does that work? I mean, do you get residuals on that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Because your name's on it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Can I borrow some money?
it's always different. It's different band to band contract.
Right, right. Yeah, you're writing something.
It's a negotiation
it
for sure.
Right, right. Okay, cool. Well, hey, Phil, thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome, man.
And Silent Rebecca over there.
Shh. Jesus.
Yeah. Don't make so much noise it's with that
so
hand waving.
Loud.
Yeah.
Jeez.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I've had a lot of fun talking with you. We're going to go out today with the Fleet Foxes from their newest album, Helplessness Blues. And this song's called Lorelei on Sub Pop again. Basically, I did this. Most of these are on Sub Pop except for the Built to Spill one because I only wanted to email one licensing person to get the okay to play this music. So it worked out great.
Excellent job.
Yeah. Thanks for working with Sub Pop so much.
You're welcome.
So I appreciate that. This is Lorelei by the Fleet Foxes. We'll be back next week on the Air Raid podcast with yet another great guest. And I hope you guys tune in for that. But until then, have a great week.
It's better to burn out, yeah, than fade away. Oh, Raid!
Who is that? Is that Def Leppard?
Look out! Gonna start a fire. You know what I'm talking about. Come on, rise up, gather round. go up in smoke. Rock on.
It's all edited and weird.
Oh my god. Yeah, yeah. They totally did some editing on that one. That's hilarious.